content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the April issue. We're going to wrap up the April issue today of Southern Living Magazine. And this week, we're going to continue a story we just began last week. Actually, a feature. It was Ivy's Kitchen. So it includes a pear salad recipe. We'll get to that. And then also our back page essay from Rick Bragg that's always on the last page of every issue. We'll wrap it up with that. All right. So let's get started. This, on the cover of the issue, we have, it has an ocean blue hue, and it is a, there's a peninsula, it appears to be dusk, or it's approaching dusk, because the lights are on in the hotels and houses here on this peninsula. And there is a more detailed description of the cover in our April 4th podcast, which you can always listen to. You can go back to our podcast, but listeners, there's one note here. Because we rely on our volunteer tech staff, we haven't been able to update the podcast with the title Southern Living as yet. So, but they're all there, and if you want to see them, you need only to go to newspapers and then Triangle Bulletin Board. And under Triangle Bulletin Board, you will see all of our podcasts each week on the Friday of each week so that you can return to any of them. And once again, it's the April 4th one that includes a more detailed description of this front cover, which is in an ocean blue hue with a brown peninsula of the town of Duck, which is on the Outer Banks. On the cover, it says, Southern Living, the South's best vacation of the year, restaurant of the year, barbecue joints, cities, classic hotels, cruises, resorts, seafood dives, and more. 50 best beach towns, the strange delight of pear salad, which we'll get to today, Erin and Ben Napier's gorgeous greenhouse, and the only way to make fried chicken by Rick Bragg, which we got to on the April 18th podcast, if you want to know that. April 18th, and it might continue on to the 25th, but I don't recall. Okay, enough about our podcast. Let's get started into Ivy's Kitchen. This is a feature in every issue of the magazine, and this is called The Strange Delight of Pear Salad. And listeners, we began this last in our last episode, but if you don't mind, we're going to just repeat those first two paragraphs just to get us situated. All right? The Strange Delight of Pear Salad, it wouldn't be Easter without this old school recipe. And this is by Ivy Odom. In the South, we use the term salad quite liberally. If you've never attended a potluck with folding tables laden with cut crystal platters bearing mysterious fruit-studded fluffs or shiny gelatin-set delights, quote-unquote, I can see how these concoctions might cause you to raise an eyebrow. But as a Southerner, I know to expect far more than lettuce when salad is on the menu. Of all the traditional dishes from the luncheons, get-togethers, and picnics of my childhood, there's one thing that reigns supreme. The recipe is simple. Open a can of pear halves. There's no place for fresh here. Set them on your serving piece of choice. In my family, this means a deviled egg plate. Dollop each with a hefty glob of mayonnaise. Don't be shy. And top with a generous sprinkle of shredded cheddar cheese. Et voila, pear salad. And listeners, there's a photo that takes up almost half the page of this pear salad. And it's sitting upon little individual, looks like bib lettuce. And then there's a green lettuce, and it's yellow with a little cherry on top and that shredded cheddar cheese, and it's on a glass deviled egg plate. And I, which honestly I wouldn't know if she hadn't said that that's what it was in the article, but it's on a glass plate. And there are some pink napkins kind of going off the edge and in the background. And we will describe the details of this plate when we get to the recipe in a very short time. Okay, back to our essay. Some folks serve it on a bed of butter lettuce. That's what that is, yes. Or with a maraschino cherry on top. But for my Nana, those frilly additions were unnecessary. Her mother never added those garnishes, so neither did she. I can't remember a meal at Nana's house when there wasn't pear salad on the table. And I know that if I were to go into my mama's pantry right now, I'd find a can or two of pears just in case we need an extra side, as she would say. It's one of those dishes, like deviled eggs or a relish tray, that's always served at Easter or any holiday in our house. Often shows up at weeknight suppers, excuse me, or even suffices as a meal all on its own, if you're not too hungry. To some, the combination of pears, mayonnaise, and cheese might appear odd, but for me, this seemingly strange recipe tastes like home, and that's the cherry on top. And, listeners, here is the recipe. Let's see. It's not too long. It's a very short recipe. Yes. Okay. Here we go. Pear salad. The active time is 15 minutes and the total time is 15 minutes. And this serves 12. Drain 3 15-ounce cans of pear halves. Excuse me. Note, some canned pears may be larger than others. Pat the pear halves dry with paper towels. Spoon at least 2 teaspoons of mayonnaise into each pear half, about a half a cup total. Top each half with shredded sharp cheddar cheese, about a half a cup total. Arrange the pear halves over butter lettuce leaves. If desired, on a serving platter. Top pear halves with whole maraschino cherries, if desired. And that's it, listeners. That's the photo. It's got little butter lettuce leaves, and upon them sit the pear halves, and upon that, the dollop of mayo, and upon that, some shredded cheddar cheese, and upon that, a maraschino cherry. So, we've got cherry red, golden yellow, white, and some spring green butter lettuce there, so it's a nice, it's a colorful plate. Okay, and that's our pear salad. And now we will turn to the feature that's at the end of every magazine to be sure that we get to this today. It's by Rick Bragg always, and it's called Southern Journal. And it has a cartoon that's about a quarter of the page. And there is a elderly man sitting in a chair, and he is oversized. It's a cartoon. He's wearing an Argyle sweater vest and a white shirt, but it's kind of gray, white or grayed, and some gray trousers and brown shoes. And his chair is upon a gray area rug with golden trim, and that's on a wooden floor. Background is a blurry white walls with the suggestion of picture frames and pictures on those walls that we don't really see. And then there's a window behind the man sitting on the chair. He's on the left. He's pointing ahead of him to 3 people who are on the right. And his head, listeners, is close to the gray ceiling. Again, he's oversized. And he's pointing to these 3 people who are standing before him. And they are adults, middle-aged to, I'll call them middle-aged. Don't be polite and call them middle-aged adults. And the one in the furthest from us is a woman with red curly hair. It looks like it's in pigtails, and she's wearing those round reading glasses, and she's smiling. And she's wearing a blue jacket, green skirt that comes to just above her knees, some brown shoes, and she's holding a indigo-colored purse that matches her jacket in one hand, the hand that's furthest from us. And she is looking at the man in the center of these three people. And the man in the center, he is looking straight at the man, oversized man, who's pointing to him. And the man in the center has a round belly. He's wearing a t-shirt, suspenders, green trousers, brown shoes. And he's got gray hair. And he's smiling. All of these people are smiling. And he's looking directly at the man in the chair. And the man in the chair is saying to this man, "And we're going to call you Doughbelly." D-O-U-H, belly. And then to this man's left and closest to the foreground to us is a man who's facing us. And he is a caricature of Rick Bragg. And he too is smiling. He's got a white beard and golden brown hair, a tan blazer, a black t-shirt, it looks like, yes, denim trousers and gray shoes. Okay, and we'll start the name game. My grandfather called them like he saw them. I never got to see my grandfather's face or hear his voice. He died in 1958, the year before I was born. I have a lot of regrets about that. He was a laughing, fighting, loving, liquor-making, hammer-swinging giant. A poor man who never bowed his head to anyone. I wish I could have seen that. The main reason I hate it so much is that I didn't receive the legacy he left to so many here in the Appalachian foothills along the Alabama-Georgia line. He never had gold or greenbacks to spread around and didn't own an acre of land. But he gave out names. He had a kind of gift for looking inside a person and, no matter what appeared on their birth certificate, seeing what they should be called, something that fit just right. You could say it was a nickname, but in many cases it was the only thing they were ever called by friends and kin. And some are etched forever into old stones that lean left and right in cemeteries here at home. Gadsden Johnson was born with a fine, dignified name. I never heard it. He was always just Pine Knot Johnson, brother to Easy Johnson. And Pine Knot is how he is remembered, cut into stone. He was tough and a little hard-headed. Pine Knot, it sings. Homer Turner, likewise, sounds perfectly nice. But my grandpa called him Pig. Why Pig? I asked my mother, assuming it was an unkind reference to his size. No, she said, he could talk to pigs. Did they talk back? I asked. And she said she reckoned so. He could not, however, communicate with mules. My mother said one day Pig was out in the field cussing a mule that was jerking him all over the place, and his wife walked out of the house saying, "Please don't take the Lord's name in vain." He said, "Well, the Lord never had to plow this mule." I asked her why my grandfather always felt compelled to try to set the world straight by renaming the entire region. And she gave me one of those looks, the ones that tell you, "Hun, you should have figured that out by yourself." Because he just loved people. And if you love people, you give them nicknames, she replied. There was Jesse Kleins, who talked to owls. He was never known as anything but Hootie. Some of my grandpa's choices were mysteries, like what he called the Woods Girls, Helen and Haveen. You mean Dootsie and Weedy, my mother corrected me. Nanny Spencer became Aunt Dude. Virgil Bundram was known as Buckshot. James Bundram, who wasn't afraid of anything on earth, was Shaker. Leona Morrison was Jabbo. Toby Morrison was Doughbelly. That's because he wore suspenders, she informed me. There was Crook Woods. I liked that. My Aunt Fine was Polecat, but she didn't really appreciate it, so my grandfather changed it to Tadpole. My mama was Pooh Boy. P-O-O-H, boy. Aunt Juanita was Snag, and Aunt Edna was Mocky Top. No one seems to recall why. He carried on this tradition with all of his grandchildren. My cousin Jeanette was Guinea, like the chicken. Cousin Alton was Baco, after God knows what. And cousin Betty was Possum Brown. My brother Sam was Samson, because he was so strong, even as a boy, even as a little boy. And then my grandpa was gone, and I was left with just my official name. It is a good one, and I'm glad to have it. But what might have happened if I'd had another name, another fine name to live up to? I wonder. And now, listeners, we will get to our next article, since we have a little bit more time left. We do. And this is called Vacation of the Year, Editor's Pick. There's nowhere on earth quite like the Outer Banks, a string of wild but well-loved barrier islands off the coast of North Carolina. And this is by Tara Masule McKay, with photographs by Peter Frank Edwards. And it begins with a double-page photograph of sunset over Currituck Sound at the Back Bar, part of the Blue Point Restaurant in Duck, which is one of the towns on the Outer Banks. And this has a, in the background are a number of, it appears to be restaurants and some vacation homes, maybe Airbnbs or Vrbos, but they're all of a light coffee-colored hue, like a cafe au lait hue, with a chocolate-colored roofs. And some of them are two-story and some one-story. And in the foreground, we have a dock stretching out among the marshes, among the fields, beach grasses, into the sound. And there are several people sitting on Adirondack chairs facing the water, and others facing those people. They're sitting on the railing of the dock. And they're people, they appear to be people of all ages, mostly families, but people of all ages, and there are children. They all look quite happy, and there's some in the background that are sitting on a table beneath an umbrella, over a black and white striped umbrella in the grasses. And then on the dock, it has ropes for banisters or handholds, ropes along either side of the dock, and people are walking back and forth from the dock. Mostly couples, but one single man, one single woman, a young girl, there are some people having a conversation at the base of the dock near one of the establishments. And there's some wheatgrass. They're called phragmites, technically. You know, those feathery things. They're light wheat-colored and feathery. And so the vacation begins. And There's a photo that begins the first one that says Oceanfront Beach House Rentals in Nag's Head. And the rentals are pink, green, yellow, and yellowish green. They're all, and some blue. They're all different pastel colors, light colors. They all have porches that are overlooking the sound. We don't see the sound. In the foreground, we see some beach grass and more of those feathery beach grasses as well. Okay. Dawn is just beginning to break as my husband Matt and I hang a left off State 12 and the pavement quickly dissolves to dirt. When we dead-end at a gate, Joe O'Grady, who has been conducting excursions in the Outer Banks for more than 25 years, is waiting to take us out on the water. His business, Coastal Kayak Touring Company, leads paddlers all over the islands. But the trip from Pine Island Audubon Center, a former duck hunting camp that is now one of the last untouched places in the northern Outer Banks, is a favorite for O'Grady. The spot preserves 2,600 acres of marshland, beaches, an upland maritime forest. We've come to explore its miles upon miles of meandering water trails that zigzag around tiny islands in the Currituck Sound. And I think you know this, listeners, but I will spell Currituck. It's C-U-R-R-I-T-U-C-K, just in case. Not everyone will know that, okay? Maybe just you North Carolinians. All right. By the time we're situated in our boats, the sun isn't quite up, but twilight is in full swing. The sky resembles a layered cake, dark gray and light blue near the top, with a marbling of peach, pale yellow, and orange pink dipping down to meet the trees. The water rolls along in silent ripples, the breeze almost undetectable. When all goes completely still, the reflection of every last cloud is mirrored on the water's glassy surface. A mullet flings its scaly body into the sky, causing a snow-white egret to swoop down to check out the commotion. Like us, the wildlife is just waking up to greet the day. Sunrise here is more than worth the early call time. And despite my 5 a.m. alarm and getting only 3 hours of sleep the night before, thanks to a last-minute flight change, I finish my paddle feeling more refreshed than I have in weeks. The Outer Banks have a funny way of doing that. Something about being surrounded by water. The chain of barrier islands is sandwiched between the Atlantic Ocean and a handful of sounds. And it makes everything else feel far away. With no outside stimulus to muddle my thoughts, it's shockingly simple to do nothing but appreciate the steady ebb and flow of the tides or the frenzied movements of a busy marsh rabbit. The morning's calm makes it easy to forget that the Outer Banks are a naturally dynamic system where water and land are in constant interaction. A strong storm or rising sea levels can completely change not only the shoreline but also the very makeup of the islands, including what plants and animals can call them home. When coastal communities started springing up across the region in the 1950s, new buildings began preventing erosion, disrupting the natural barrier dynamics and making it possible to form a local economy around tourism. Still, for all of humankind's efforts to keep the land in place, the very thing that makes the Outer Banks so bewitching also leaves them entirely exposed to the elements. Hurricanes, tropical depressions, and 60-mile-per-hour nor'easter winds strong enough to bury cars in sand. The Outer Banks have seen it all, and still, the narrow strip of sand persists. If you're a first-time visitor, it pays to know the lay of the land. Keep in mind that the Outer Banks stretch for 120 miles and encompass three main regions, the Northern Beaches, Hatteras Island, and Roanoke Island. It's about a four-hour drive from top to bottom. And in all, there are more than a dozen towns and villages to explore. Here's a look at four of our favorites. And listeners, there's a full-page photo here of a lighthouse. And in the foreground, there's a boardwalk among the dune grasses that are leading to that lighthouse. And there are some trees. It's called the Bodie Island Lighthouse in Nag's Head. It is black and white, horizontally striped, three of each to be precise. And there is a woman walking her dog on this boardwalk that goes through the marshes and out into the water. And the lighthouse is reflected in the water beneath it. And then there's a two-story home, probably the, I would think, the forest ranger's home or caretaker's home there. Okay, so they talked about four towns, and we don't have much time, so I'm just going to read the first paragraph of each or so, or just a summary so you get a sense of it. Corolla. We know this is famous, listeners, for the horses. It's a wild escape. We're a real biodiversity hotspot, Pine Island Audubon Center Director Robbie Fern tells me as he eases his beat-up truck through a narrow path in the woods with branches slapping and scraping against metal as we go along. He's showing me the side of the sanctuary most visitors don't get to see. O'Grady's kayak tours and 2.5-mile nature trail are the public-facing portion. These wide expanses of dense maritime forest are largely left alone. And then, listeners, we'll go on to... The wild horses are on deck. There is a photo of them here, grazing along in the water right near the marshlands, quite close to the populated establishments. Duck is a quaint resort town. It's the place you probably imagine when you picture an idyllic beach town. It's got a 0.78-mile boardwalk connecting all of the community's best attractions. And there's a town park. Nag's Head is a family-friendly beach getaway about 30 minutes south of Duck and central to the region. Nag's Head is a salt-of-the-earth coastal town. You won't come across much in the way of fancy restaurants and ritzy resorts, but you will find a sense of authenticity that permeates each business and every square inch of the sandy beaches. There is a smattering of hotels, inns, and motels, but rental houses, either plopped directly on the shore or located within easy walking distance, are the primary draw. And lastly, Manteo. This is the last of the four towns that they highlight here in this article, listeners. Manteo, M-A-N-T-E-O, is a historic waterfront hamlet. Roanoke Island consists of two towns, Manteo and Juan Cheese, both named for Native Americans who once lived there. Juan Cheese is largely residential, but Manteo, with its many historic attractions, is popular with visitors. And that's our time for today, listeners. And we hope you've enjoyed it and hope that you'll listen next time. I am Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this